Welcome to the IYBA's podcast channel, powered by Robert Allen Law, The Yacht Lawyers. Each week, we release discussions from our past conferences, summits, and educational events specifically related to the yacht brokerage community. With more than 1,800 members and growing, the International Yacht Brokers Association, IYBA, is the world's largest and most influential association for the yacht brokerage and charter industry. IYBA is dedicated to professionalism and ethics in all aspects of yacht transactions. This week, our segment comes from Yacht Sales and the Law, 2020.
Hello, and welcome back to day two of Yacht Sales and the Law. I'm Paul Flannery, Executive Director of the International Yacht Brokers Association. Yacht Sales and the Law 2020 is brought to you by Ali Moss Rogers Lindsay, Lauderdale Marine Center, Yacht World, and the folks at Howard S. Reeder Incorporated Customs Brokers. Our space has been provided by Pier 66, and we're connected remotely through JV connectivity. Yesterday, we met Bubba Calhoun and Bill Boatwise, the protagonists to our story, As the Prop Turns. We began with a bit of a rocky road as Bubba's learning what it's like to be a yacht broker. David Moss provided great commentary and moderation to our expert panels.
What the hell has Chad got to say now? Can't Sven can't run the boat. Well, I'm a broker now. I fix problems. We gonna get Frank to run. Heck, he knows the boat. Problem solved.
Ha! A huge blaze in Fort Lauderdale ruined two multi-million dollar yachts. The blaze started early in the morning, and firefighters were on the scene for a large part of the day just trying to get this thing under control. Local 10 News reporter Roy Ramos live in Fort Lauderdale with the story.
Bill Boatwise. What? You gotta be kidding me. It sank? No, like it's literally like at the bottom of the river. It literally sank, and there was an explosion as well. Come on. He's suing everybody? Including me? Frank's in jail? I don't understand. This is a complete and utter disaster. You gotta be kidding me. The black water tank exploded and there's fecal matter everywhere.
This is horrifying. This is horrifying. This is not good. This is not good. I have no idea what we're gonna do. I didn't think that fiberglass could burn that quickly.
It can't.
Okay, yeah, all right, I guess I'll wait to hear from somebody. Yeah, hopefully it's not the FBI. I mean, they've only been here once. Ah, this is fun. I'm enjoying myself. Be a yacht broker, they said. It'd be a good time. Yeah, meet new people. Go to interesting places.
Welcome back for the final segment of Yacht Sales and the Law. We just watched Act 7 of As the Prop Turns. I'm here again with Jeff Cox, maritime lawyer at Cox & Company. We are going to discuss some of the issues that were raised in Act 7. But one thing I want to talk about at the beginning, which really set this whole chain of events in motion, was the fact that the buyer's captain was unable to enter the U.S. on his visa. In an earlier segment, we talked about how, you know, historically, foreign crew were unable to work on U.S. documented vessels because they couldn't get a B-1 visa. And although there's been a recent change to immigration regulations that allows certain foreign crew to get a B-1 visa, they have to be able to show that the boat they're working on, they're going to be working on, will be in both U.S. waters and outside the U.S. in foreign waters. And in this case, the buyer's captain didn't have that documentation. Now, when CBP issues some more formal guidance on this in the next few months, we expect there to be like a letter or a form that these foreign crew can carry with them to show the CBP officer explaining the visa category that they're using, and there will be some guidance about the kind of documentation that they need to provide to show that they're going to be working outside the U.S. Right. But moving from that into the issue that it caused, which was having to hire the seller's captain to move the boat, mm-hmm. and then obviously what resulted from that. What kind of liability do you think the buyer is looking at in this situation?
Well, the buyer is going to have a problem with his insurance company at the outset. The insurance company likely required him to have a pre-approved captain running the boat only. And it wasn't clear to me from the facts that this captain ever was approved by the insurance company. So at the outset, the insurance company is going to be looking at denying the claim entirely. And they probably would get away with doing that because they didn't sign up for the risk of having unknown captains driving this boat. They signed up for a known risk of this captain with this resume running the boat. That's what they signed up for. That's the contract they made with the buyer. So they're not going to be bound to pay any losses. There may be some argument that these losses weren't caused by the fact that there was a unapproved captain, but the contract was breached. And insurance contracts carry with them a duty of utmost fidelity. And it's likely that the buyer won't be able to show that they had incredible utmost fidelity to their insurance company by putting a different captain on the boat. So it's, you know, not knowing full investigation of what's happening here, I would expect that there will be no insurance payout on this set of facts.
And that would apply to both the casualty, the loss of the vessel. The
insurance company is just not they're not going to be a party to it.
Right.
They didn't sign up for this.
But it would also apply to any liability for damage caused to third parties.
Exactly. And that liability will come back to the buyer. The vessel could be sued in rem for the damage that it did to the dock as a maritime elision, and the owner will be liable for that too. The owner would have some possible defenses that we may talk about later, but I would expect if I'm the owner that I am not getting my insurance proceeds and I'm probably rebuilding the stock and whatever else may have happened.
And what about the seller? Do you think the fact that it's the seller's captain creates any liability for the seller?
I would expect that if enough money is at stake that there will be lawyers who will try to thread the needle and say something to the effect of this captain was your employee and you allowed your employee to go run this boat, and your employee, it's not clear to me how the captain may or may not have caused this, but I would expect that the actions will be brought, and you'll be put to the test of whether or not you can defend against that. I mean, it's a stretch, but if there's enough money there. I would say that there's enough to get the discovery. So you can anticipate that you're going to be in that litigation. You're going to be responding to it. You may prevail, but I would expect that you're going to be in that litigation.
I had a client, this has happened a couple times actually, where the buyer asked the seller's captain to relocate the vessel after closing. Mm-hmm. The seller was going to continue employing the captain on his next vessel. So it was he was an employee throughout this period, and both times, I asked them to sign a letter agreement saying that, the captain's working for us. He's not the seller's employee when he's moving the boat from A to B, just to head off that sort of an action.
Yeah, I'm aware of a situation where fortunately it wasn't directly one of my clients that this happened to, but there's a custom sportfish builder up in the Carolinas who sent a member of the family on a prolonged delivery to the new owner of this custom sport fishing boat. And this member of the family was also a boat captain and was, I believe, running the boat early in the morning before the sun came up when the boat struck the reef down in Puerto Rico. And some people watching this may know what I'm talking about now. It's sort of a known thing in the industry. But my understanding is that litigation is still going on and it's been about 3 years. So yeah, there's sign a letter agreement.
Yeah, it's always better to protect yourself with a piece of paper.
Better to be prepared than disappointed. I mean, it's easy enough to with a brief letter agreement to just cut it off, and a lawyer who was looking at it would just say, "Nah, there's nothing here. This is not a door we can walk through." But without that, if there's deep pockets, they're going to try to find a way.
Now you mentioned defenses that the buyer might have. Under certain circumstances, a buyer is entitled to limit his liability Can you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. In maritime law, there's a concept, which is an old ancient concept, and it's a concept that's foreign to many non-maritime lawyers and frankly, most of the world. And that is that if you are a vessel owner and you have a ship or a yacht and it's on the out on the sea and something happens, something bad, your financial exposure is limited to the value of the boat. The reason for it is without it, you wouldn't have shipping. You couldn't have people buying ships and having them going on the high seas way out of their reach and control and have something happen where the owner of the vessel had nothing to do with it, no privity, and the owner of the vessel could theoretically have all of their wealth exposed. There'd be no shipping. There'd be no international commerce. So over the course of history, this international maritime law concept of limitation of liability has arisen, and it's a real thing. And some people are shocked by it. But for, the policy of it is necessary in order to have international commerce. You simply can't ship everything back and forth between nations to have international trade and have the people who own the boats have their financial fortunes at risk. So it's a necessary concept, but there it is.
And when you say limited to the value of the vessel, it's the post-casualty value of the vessel.
Yeah.
If the boat's on the
bottom.
Yeah,
if the boat's at the bottom.
It could be zero.
It could be negative. It costs money to get it, yeah.
So if, let's say, the dock owner in this case wanted to sue the owner, the owner of the yacht, that is, for the damage caused to the dock.
Right.
The owner could assert limitation.
He may well.
And potentially avoid liability
exactly.
to the dock owner.
Exactly.
And, there are exceptions to limitation. You mentioned if the owner has privity and knowledge.
Right.
But in this case, if it was just the negligence of the operator,
right.
It's possible he would be able to limit.
It's possible, yeah.
Now, he'd have certain other responsibilities. I mean, he would still have, he'd be responsible for wreck removal.
Yes.
And he may or may not have insurance for that.
Right, right. And that could be a big deal.
And that's actually become more of an issue in...
Yeah, that's salt on the wound.
Yeah. Under state law, that's become, there have been a number of issues with abandoned vessels and...
Oh, yeah.
Municipalities that have to spend money to raise them and remove them.
Oh, years ago, when I was at your firm, it was a period of multiple hurricanes, and there was wrecks all over the intercoastal, and we were dealing with it constantly. And it turns out there's probably about 17 different agencies that are all going like this, trying to say who's responsible for getting this out of here. Is it the Coast Guard? Is it the Army Corps of Engineers? Is it the Fish and Wildlife? I mean, who? Whose issue is it if there's a sunk boat out in the middle of the intercoastal? And that was something that we were dealing with, pretty regularly with all the hurricanes that we had in the early 2000s. So that's a big deal.
And in the end, I mean, whoever pays to remove it, the owner's going to be on the hook.
Right, right. Yeah, because they're going to go back to the owner and try to get paid.
Now, sort of expanding from the particular fact pattern that we've been talking about, what other sorts of liabilities have you seen that arise post-closing or that give rise to litigation between buyer and seller after closing?
Well, I mean, there may be a claim of negligence for the referral of the captain. There may be a claim of negligence for not acknowledging that it's unlikely that this captain would be insurable on the boat without at least giving a resume and an opportunity for the underwriter to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. So I would be a little bit concerned about who made the recommendation. And I would counsel anybody thinking of doing that just assume that somebody needs to be approved in writing with a resume by the insurance underwriter. Just assume it. Nobody's going to be mad at you for trying to get somebody approved if the insurance company didn't care. And I can't imagine a scenario where they wouldn't care because the insurance company is signing up for a discrete risk. And the risk is this captain and that boat. And the insurance company has the opportunity to evaluate that captain's credentials and make a determination if they want to underwrite that risk. And if the boat owner varies that deal even a little bit, the insurance company can exit the whole scenario and just avoid coverage.
Yeah, that was something we were talking about earlier in the context of surveys. And sometimes people want to withhold a survey from an insurer because they're afraid there's something in there that would cause them concern. But that's the last thing you want to do.
No, that's the last thing you want
Anytime to do. Anytime you fail to disclose something to an insurer, you're giving them a reason to
that's
deny the
absolutely
claim.
Absolutely right. Underlying concept in insurance law is the concept that there's a Latin term for it, which I'll butcher, uberae fidelae or something along those lines, utmost fidelity. You have to be completely forthright to your insurance company. And if you're not, that will give them a reason to avoid coverage, which means that you'd have then been sending premiums to them for no reason because you have no insurance. So yeah, you have to be totally forthright to a fault.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think you're going to avoid, put it this way. Why would an insurance company not want to insure a boat as a result of something on a survey? They wouldn't want to insure a boat as a result of something on a survey because that something on the survey increases their risk. And they'll insure it for a proper premium, but their premium is calculated based on what they know to be the risks. And if you avoid giving that information to them, it's completely unreasonable to expect them to pay, actually. So they're going to demand a survey. You know, I can't think of a deal where the insurance company has said, fine, we'll just insure the boat, no survey required. I can't think of a time. And it shouldn't happen that way because the insurance company won't be in business for long if they do that. So
I've seen a few other things that have happened post-closing that have sort of arisen in the context of a deal. For example, I had a client who was involved in a situation where a buyer said there was something wrong with the vessel's engines. And normally you take a boat as is.
Right.
There's a complete disclaimer of warranty. In this case, he had done an engine survey, but he said that somehow they had doctored the oil samples or something. Basically, he was trying to get around the contract and get to fraudulent inducement.
Hmm.
And you know, you try and do everything you can within the four corners of the contract, but there's other causes of action.
Yeah, you get outside of contract law and a tort and things like that, and that sounds like what they were trying to do because they were going to lose in contract. You know, the contract law is what it is. It's, you know, this is the sale of goods governed by the Uniform Commercial Code, and if you're within the four corners of the contract, if you've hired a surveyor and you've accepted the boat, accepted the engines, that's it. Too bad, so sad, right? But to get outside of the contract into tort remedies, that's a fact-dependent analysis that it would be an uphill climb. But if you had, facts are stubborn, right? If you have them and you can show that they did doctor, there wasn't the oil from that engine or something like that. I mean, you can imagine we've seen worse things these days. But if that was true, then what's in the contract is really not the issue. The issue now is tort law. Did you have a duty to give me an accurate oil analysis of the oil in this engine? And did you breach that duty? And was I damaged by that breach of the duty? So, I mean, that's really outside of the contract and very difficult. You can't contract around it, frankly. So mm-hmm. It is what it is.
One thing, you mentioned that, these are all governed by the UCC. I think for a lot of non-lawyers, they look at sales of vessels and sort of admiralty generally, and there's a certain amount of mystery around it. Mm-hmm. You think that there's a different set of rules that apply.
Right.
You're in admiralty jurisdiction. They don't realize that the sale of a vessel isn't in admiralty jurisdiction.
Right, exactly.
And it's just like any other sale of goods under state law.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All warranty law, everything else that applies.
No, the issue isn't, there's no contract for the sale and purchase of a vessel or the construction of the sale and purchase of a vessel is a dry land contract governed by the Uniform Commercial Code in the United States. The problem for guys like us is to know the boundary of where maritime law issues start and where they stop. It's not so much a maritime issue with yacht purchases, but it's all the ancillary stuff that comes with it, the hiring of captains and crews and chartering and things like that. Those are all maritime
liens,
issues.
Liens.
Yes, all that stuff, which is inverted for non-maritime folks in terms of, first in time, first in right kind of stuff, last in time, last in right, compared to, real estate deals and things like that. The other area that I've seen some confusion, obfuscation, is with respect to mandatory or contractual obligations to disclose material defects and things like that. People put that in contracts, and if you want to sign and agree to that, fine, go for it. But that there's not something that's inherent in the sale of goods that says that you have to do that. This is not a real estate deal. It's a sale of goods. It's a widget, a complicated, big, expensive widget, but it's a widget. And we see that sometimes. And that's it certainly opens doors to people who are looking for a cause of action, which I think is where that's headed and why it's in those contracts.
I see it, you know, even in the EBA listing agreement, there's a set of reps and warranties about the condition of the vessel. Yeah. And when I'm representing an owner, I just delete those.
I do too. It's gone. Yeah. It's the first thing, it's gone.
We're not making any warranty as a condition. The buyer has to rely on a survey.
Do you want to be in court and you want to go buy another boat?
I mean, right.
Because if you make those warranties and representations, all you have to do is give the other side a colorable claim to get past the motion to dismiss. And now you're in discovery, which is the worst part of litigation, because now you have to respond and you have to produce and everything else. It's got to go. It's got to be out of the contract. So we take it out too, 100%.
Now, the converse of that is making sure buyers understand that they're really relying on their surveyor.
Yes.
That they're not going to have a remedy if, after the sale closes, they discover something.
Right.
So they have to be really, you know, confident.
Right. And the surveyor, of course, has a disclaimer at the end of it.
Right.
That anything that I didn't find, it's not my fault because I didn't tear the boat apart, because there's a limit as to how far an inspection can go. You know, but it's one of those things where does the law follow business or does the business follow the law, right? We need to survey boats. And I think everybody's doing the best they can with that.
Another thing, you know, we mentioned earlier, but it can be a problem post-closing, is when you do have liens that pop up. Because, you know, in maritime law, obviously liens don't have to be recorded.
Right.
So how do you protect a buyer?
So, we use, in situations where a buyer is an entity and a seller is an entity, we use a warranty of title, which basically brings in the protections that the bill of sale would have had if you were dealing with an individual. And we do that because the entity could be wound up or dissolved shortly after closing, and all of your representations and warranties that are found on the bill of sale would now be for nothing because that entity no longer exists. So what we do with the warranty of title is we transfer those representations and warranties to what I would call a solvent defendant, which is your seller, who presumably is a guy who, if you had to sue, you could collect from. And frankly, that's as good as you can get with a boat deal, because there are maritime liens that could arise. You could have put fuel in the boat the day before closing and not paid the bill. The marina with the fuel dock has a lien now, unrecorded, undiscoverable. But if they show up a week after closing and say, excuse me, we're owed, you know, X dollars, we never got paid, the new owner of the boat has that, because as they say, a yacht or a ship attracts liability like barnacles. You know, so it's certainly a risk. But in reality, it doesn't come up that often. I've been doing it for a long time. It doesn't come up. It's a theoretical risk that we have to address. There's a few protections, like the warranty of title we have. There's an equitable doctrine of latches, which is if you sit on your rights for too long, you're not going to go into a court and find some judge to say, yeah, I know you bought this boat 3 years ago and you know, you just couldn't get around to bringing this action, but now we're gonna allow you to use the courts to dig this up and beat the guy over the head with it 3 years later. The court's likely to tell you to get out of the court. And so there's that. That's an equitable doctrine. Other things that you can do, you know, you got your warranty of title. We use crew releases.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult to say how enforceable they would be. Most of the cases that you'll read would say almost never.
Yeah, their wages are sacred.
Yeah, yeah. And a seaman is a ward of the court.
Right.
And you know, you could have them swear up and down 15 different ways that they've been paid, they're not owed anything, and then 2 weeks after closing, they could say, oh, by the way, I was owed, you know, 10 days of vacation time that I forgot about when I signed that release, and now I claim I have a lien against the boat, and I'm going to have it arrested and everything else. So there's that. But another thing that actually acts to protect against unknown liens is quite simply the cost of arresting a boat to enforce a maritime lien. $30,000 maybe out of the gate as a ballpark figure to, you know, hire a lawyer, get the marshals involved, you know, file the action, probably 30 grand before you even start. So it better be worth it. So a lot of claims that are less than that, just they're not enforced.
Yeah, although on a documented vessel, it's relatively easy to record a notice of a claim
Correct.
Of a lien, and then, you know, if that happens close to a sale, they have some leverage.
Now they got leverage, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, which, you know, and that's only, as far as I know, it's only U.S. Coast Guard documented vessels that have that facility. You could file a notice of claim of lien saying, you know, attention anybody who pulled an abstract on this boat, this guy owes me money and hasn't paid me. That doesn't help you sell a boat. You know, because now you got everybody's got their radar turned on. It's like, why does this guy? Why is there a captain that's claiming he hasn't been paid on this boat that I'm thinking about having my buy or sell?
And there's no sort of process to establish the validity of the claim. They just have to. It's just
no. They just send it in. It's just. It's simply you write it and send it in, and they record it. Now, there may be some mechanism to have it removed or to show cause or something like that, but I've never had to deal with it because it's just one of those things that you don't let happen. With a U.S. flag boat, you make sure you pay your bills because somebody could just in half of an hour send this thing and it'll be recorded against your document on your boat and it'll be seen by the next person that wants to buy your boat because they're going to pull an abstract. So it's right there.
Now, going back to the warranty of title, which you know is the primary defense against maritime liens and other defects in title post-closing, you know, we've gotten pushback sometimes either from people who, just as a matter of personal policy, don't give out personal guarantees, you know, are sort of very averse to it.
Yep.
And then also more recently in Europe, we've seen lawyers who are pushing more and more to limit the personal guarantee or warranty of title either to a certain amount or to a certain duration or both.
Yeah. Well, you got to push back because, first of all, you should establish your right to have the warranty of title in a document list with your first offer. We're going to offer this for your boat. These are the documents you're going to provide, and one of them is going to be a warranty of title from the beneficial owner. You know, when they want to sell their boat, they'll agree to that. But when they get to closing, they may push back on it because somebody will say, "Oh, geez, you know, this guy just doesn't sign those things. Mm-hmm. It's his policy."
Sometimes it's just a matter of explaining to them that this is a warranty only as to title. This has nothing to do with condition or anything else. You're just saying.
The word warranty means different things.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That's true. I will say that I've also had situations where people tried to resist signing a warranty of title, but I'll tell you that they've never succeeded because at the end of the day, I'm not going to let my client buy the boat without it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if it's in the dock list, it's you know the seller's in breach.
Right.
You know, so if you don't sign it, you're in breach.
Right.
We're not closing. You want to sell your boat or not? The dock list and this. Like you said, maybe on the international deals where they see the word warranty of title and they're like, maybe I don't want to do that. Or somebody might say, this entity that owns the boat shouldn't have to sign a warranty of title because it won't be dissolved and all this other stuff.
Right.
Well, if you tell me that you're not willing to sign a warranty of title, immediately I'm concerned that there's problems with the title. You know, it's one of those things that if you protest too much, you've only exacerbated my suspicions, and now I think that there's a reason why you won't sign it, because if the title of the boat was clean and you had no skeletons in your closet or anything to be concerned with, you should have no resistance to sign it. It's kind of like, there's nothing wrong here, there's nothing to see, but don't investigate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's tough. And that's probably why I've never, ever closed a deal without one if there was entities involved. You know, with individuals, the bill of sale covers it, really.
Right,
I mean, maybe we do add a little more protection, but the bill of sale really, covers it. And you know, as real of a risk as it can be and as real dollars as it can be, in actual practice, it doesn't come up that often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one out of 100 deals, you hear somebody squeal about it and that's about it. You know,
a few times I've had people who resisted a personal guarantee, were willing to give a guarantee from another entity that they could show was, you know, capitalized but even then, you could pull it out after closing.
The problem is that it's in the form of an affidavit. And if you move to another entity, the question is, does that entity have basis for knowledge that they're swearing to? You know, so you get into that issue too. It's got to be from the guy, yeah,
from an individual.
Yeah, the rich guy you're buying the boat from.
Yeah.
He's the guy who would know. He's the guy who would know, did the last captain get paid or did he leave in a huff and not get paid? He's the guy who, you know, that's, you know, a lot of the things that could theoretically give rise to a lien are sloppiness, you know, unpaid crew, dockage bill slipped through the cracks. The other stuff is getting into like wholesale fraud,
right?
Know, like a mortgage and something like that got slipped in. I mean, that's a different story,
right?
You know, that's a if you got somebody who's going to those lengths, that's another story altogether,
right?
You know, but the stuff that we you know might see on the edges it would be like the you know, repair bill from Rybovich that didn't get paid in time or whatever, you know. But
and usually you don't even have to resort to the warranty of title. Somebody will just pay that.
No, somebody will pick up a phone call and say, hey, we're closing on this deal. Let's get this guy paid. You know, or you might pick up the phone and say, hey, you've been paid or, you know, just whatever you can do. And it works out in practice a lot easier than, it may appear to when you look at, you know, particularly if you're not a maritime attorney, you look at these laws, you're like, oh my God, how could you possibly ever even close a deal? It works out.
Well, it's tough because, you know, aside from getting, you know, letters from the captain or the manager, people saying that all the bills have been paid, there's no way really to do due diligence. You can't go and call every marina the boat's been in.
You couldn't know.
Yeah.
We need to track the AIS backwards, you know, through history.
No one does that.
No. It would cost a fortune. I mean, we'd have to hire consulting teams to go out and track it down. It would.
And even then, you could have missed something.
And the juice wouldn't be worth the squeeze.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, if you have a solvent defendant that you're buying the boat from, and something comes up, you make a phone call and say, hey, guess what? Somebody's saying that they weren't paid, and we have this warranty of title that you signed 3 months ago. Here's the wiring instructions, and here's the invoice, and that's probably the end of the story. The guy's going to pay it, you know, because you got him dead to rights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like, why would you want to even expose yourself to the hassle of what your next 2 years of your life will look like? You know, nobody wants to deal with it, so they pay it, you know.
Well, are there any other sort of post-closing issues that you can think of?
Every deal is different, you know. Every time you close a deal, there's different post-closing issues that come up. A lot of them have to do with what does the new owner do next? You know, is he going to be going into the shipyard and getting a refit? Or is he hiring a new set of crew? Is he keeping the crew that have been there? Sometimes after closing, you know, they'll turn around and put a mortgage on the boat. And, you know, sometimes they do that during the closing, but sometimes after. It's as your father put it, a three-dimensional chess game with changing rules. So it goes on and on and on. You know, it all depends on the situation, and when you think you've seen it all, just give it a week. There's something else coming. So.
Well, I think that's a good note to end it on. Paul, I think that's all we got.
David, thank you so much. I think you did a masterful job of moderating all of our panel discussions over the course of the last 2 days. There's no doubt that Bill Boatwise and Bubba Calhoun provided some interesting opportunities for learning. You know, we got the opportunity or the chance to follow a deal from a somewhat normal beginning to a calamitous and explosive end, let's say. I think we had great expertise in all of our panels. Tell me, how was your feel for the educational value of the 2 days?
I think it went very well. I think the story provided a great framework to explore some of the issues around yacht sales and the law. I think we were able to talk about everything from customs duty, listing agreements,